This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is songwriter, singer, and guitarist John Prine. In a review of his new album, The Tree of Forgiveness, our rock critic Ken Tucker said that Prine's knack for colloquial language and metrical precision has been an inspiration to many younger singer-songwriters. Prine released his first album in 1971 with several songs that remain staples of his repertoire, like Angel from Montgomery, Paradise, Sam Stone, and Hello in There. Among the many people who have recorded his songs are Johnny Cash, Bonnie Raitt, and Bette Midler. In 2016, he was honored by the writers organization PEN for Lyrics of Literary Excellence. Last year, Prine won the Artist of the Year Award at the Americana Awards. It's kind of amazing that he's still performing. In 1996, he had neck surgery to remove a cancerous tumor. The surgery also removed parts of his neck, severed some nerves in his tongue, and damaged several salivary glands. In 2013, he was operated on for lung cancer. He's made a remarkable comeback. Tree of Forgiveness, his first album of new songs in 13 years, has gotten some great reviews, and he's been touring. Let's start with a track from the new album. This is Summer's End, co-written with Pat McLaughlin. Brandi Carlile sings backup vocals.
Summer's ends around the bend, just flying. The swimming suits are on the line, just drying. I'll meet you there for our conversation. I hope I didn't ruin your whole vacation. Well, you never know how far from home you're feeling until you've watched the shadows cross the ceiling. Well, I don't know, but I can see it snowing. In your car, the windows are wide open. Just come on home. Come on home. No, you don't have to be alone. Just come on home. Valentine's, break hearts and minds.
That's John Prine from his new album, The Tree of Forgiveness. John Prine, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you here. Is there a story behind that song?
Well, the big story behind that particular song, Summer's End, first of all, it's my favorite track from The Tree of Forgiveness. You know, it just came out so pretty. A good buddy of mine, Pat McLaughlin, and I wrote that song. And we've been writing together. We've been friends longer than this, but we've been writing together since my Missing Years record in 91. And it's just uncanny the way we write together. I mean, we can finish each other's sentences, you know. I'll just throw an image at him and he comes back with one. And we don't really decide what the subject is that we're writing about. We just kind of go with whatever sounds good and feels good to both of us. And the fact that that song ended, like, that's how we approached it, and it ended up as pretty as it did, and as lonesome and many other things, was a surprise to me, because we were literally going, like, it was like ping pong. We were going back and forth with each line in the song.
What about the melody?
The melody is just another simple John Prine patented melody. I mean, all I'm trying to do is play a freight train, I think.
You know? I mean,
really.
The song?
I just pick up that's how I learned to finger pick, was I learned how to finger pick playing, trying to pick like Elizabeth Cotton and Mississippi John Hurt. So much so that I used to put myself, when I was 14 years old, I'd sit in the closet in the dark in case I ever went blind to see if I could play.
Wow. That's pretty strange.
Yeah, you're telling me.
So can you do it? I mean, do you ever have to look down at your fingers when you're playing?
I can't. My belly's too big.
Ha.
I can't see. I can't see my hands. Good thing I practiced in the dark.
You've been through a lot in the past few years. You've had neck cancer and lung cancer. Can we talk about how you were able to get back into shape to be able to perform and tour? I mean, the neck surgery severed nerves in your tongue. It damaged salivary glands. Did you have to learn to sing or speak again?
I had to do some. They gave me a speech therapist. That was part of the therapy when I was just getting over the initial surgery, the neck surgery. It was a pretty big surgery. It was my first really big surgery, and it was a big one. And I didn't realize I had any slur in my speech whatsoever, but it killed some of the nerves in your tongue, and it kind of made you have, I guess they would call it like lazy, you know, where your tongue would just go to one side naturally, and you'd slur some of your words. So I did some speech therapy, but I told the, when I was going in for that surgery, I had talked to the surgeon and the radiologist, and they had to do a lot of radiation on my throat, right across my vocal cords. And the radiologist was explaining to me he was going to make a shield for my vocal cords. And I said, have you ever heard me sing? I said, if you leave me with something, if I can make a noise, I said, I'll come out with a voice on the other end, you know? And the surgeon told me my golf swing would improve after surgery. And I said, I hate golf. So at least they left me with a voice to sing. I think it improved my voice, if anything. I had always had a hard time listening to my singing before my surgery.
So you got a new voice and you feel different about it?
Yeah, it dropped down lower and it feels friendlier to me. So I can actually sit in the studio and listen to my singing played back before I run the other way.
So, you know, in addition to the neck surgery that you had for cancer, a few years later you had lung cancer and you had an operation on one of your lungs. So what was it like to learn how to be able to get enough breath to support your singing?
Well, luckily I had a friend who was a trainer, you know. He individually trained people for either weight loss and stuff like that. We were friends. We just liked to get together and BS, you know. And he, when I told him I had to get the surgery, he volunteered to come to our house and help me get back in shape to get on the road. He had me running up and down our staircase three times. Then he'd put a guitar around my neck, and I'd sing three songs without taking a breath, you know. And this was all after losing half a lung. And that, I didn't know I could train like that. My wife didn't either, you know, because I hadn't previously put that much into training before.
I like that, but because it's tailored to who you are and what you do, as opposed to giving you, you know, just the standard exercises.
Exactly. I'm no good with that. If somebody tells me to work or exercise, I go the other way. I'll come up with an excuse.
So one more thing about the surgeries. I know you knew Roger Ebert, and he gave a boost to your career really early on. Before anybody knew you, he gave you a great review when you were just performing in Chicago before you'd recorded. And I don't know if you remain close, but he had cancer, and he had jaw surgery that basically left him unable to speak. I was wondering if you communicated with him at all about your surgery. I think he would have still been alive.
Well, after Roger initially got, you know, sick, I had played a show, and him and his wife came to it. And this was after my surgery. It was when I was out touring Behind the Missing Years. And we got to talk a little bit, but obviously it was a social situation, you know. It was more like we looked at each other like we're members of the club, you know, both having been through our surgeries.
Yeah.
Him even more so. He was really, at the particular time that he wrote a review on me, I was a mailman still. And I was just singing this one night a week in the Chicago club, the Fifth Peg on West Armitage. and Roger had walked out on a movie that he was supposed to review for the next day. This was a Thursday night, and Friday was the big day for the entertainment section in Chicago Sun-Times. And Roger's reviews, he always got his own page, the back page of the entertainment section. And he, instead of reviewing the movie, he said he walked into this pub to get a beer because the popcorn was too salty in the movie theater. And somebody told him to go in the back room and listen to this kid. I was the kid. And he wrote a full page on singing mailman delivers the message. I think it was the headline.
That's great.
And I never had an empty seat after that. Wow. And I was still, like I say, I was still making my living as a mailman. And I was singing after that three nights a week and two shows a night. And there was a line outside. And things just got better from then on.
This would have been about what, 1969?
Late 1970.
Okay.
Early 71 is when I got my record contract. And mm-hmm. I had a record come out by August of 71. Things happened really fast.
So let's talk about your background. You grew up in Maywood, Illinois. Was that like a small town outside of Chicago?
Yeah, it's an old suburb, you know, almost old as the city itself. It was right next to the suburb Oak Park, where Hemingway's from. Hmm. And there was a stark difference between Maywood and Oak Park. Maywood was like full of minorities, you know. My mother and father came up from Kentucky and settled in Maywood because it was they had the American Can Company there. My dad got a job there in the 30s. And helped organize the Steelworkers Union. And Maywood was really different than the other suburbs around it. One suburb would be all Italian-Americans, and the next one would be all Polish-Americans, and another suburb. There was kind of clusters of ethnic neighborhoods. And Maywood had, we were about 50% African-American, Hispanics, and people from the South that had moved there for factory work. And when I look back on it, I think it was a pretty nice environment to grow up in, because I was, I know when I got in the Army, a lot of guys I was stationed with had never been friends with anybody from a different background at all, you know, and I felt like I grew up in a good background where I had friends from all kind of places.
So was your father from Paradise, West Kentucky?
He was actually born down the road in Mercer, Kentucky, but he ended up over in Paradise because his father was a carpenter, and he'd work he'd stay 3 months in a town, rent a house, and when the job was done, he'd pull his family up and move to the next town. My dad went to something like 11 different elementary schools and many different high schools, too, because his father moved around so much. But when my grandfather would get a job and didn't want to uproot my father would end up in Paradise with all of his cousins from the Smith side of the family. My mother was born and raised in Paradise.
So you have a pretty famous song called Paradise.
Right.
That's about Paradise, Kentucky, and how beautiful it is and how the main character in your song wants to go back there. But his father tells him that it's basically too late because it's been hauled away by the coal trains. Did you see that happen to Paradise?
I was in the Army, and my dad sent me a newspaper clipping because he knew how much I liked Paradise. When we would go there in my childhood. We would go there as often as we could to see my mother's sisters and my dad's family. And so he sent me this clipping and said, that's it, Paradise is gone. You know, they bought up the town, tore the town down, and strip mined the whole area. Well, and so I wrote the song probably just after I got out of the Army. I wrote it for my dad. I realized that years later that I just wanted my dad to... I put him in the song so he would know I was a country songwriter. He was a huge country music fan, and I used to sing Hank Williams Sr. stuff for him, and Ernest Tubb and Roy Cuff. I put on a little show for him when I first learned to play guitar.
So let's hear Paradise, and this is from your 1971 debut album, John Prine.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Adria Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County?
So that's John Prine's famous song Paradise from his 1971 debut album called John Prine. So you grew up with a lot of country music because of your father. It sounds like you turned toward it as opposed to rebelling against it.
Oh, yeah. I grew up with rock and roll, but when I learned how to play the guitar, it was from my oldest brother, Dave. Dave is 10 years older than me, and he taught himself how to play fiddle and mandolin and guitar and banjo. And so he came from an old-timey country music thing. And also, he was big into the folk boom of the early 60s. And so when he taught me to play guitar, that's the kind of music I learned to play, because that's what he taught me. He gave me a Carter Family record, and I learned all those songs. And not too long after that, I started writing when I was 14. And my melodies always came out like old-timey country stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was trying to please my dad. I wanted to sing some of his favorite songs that he listened to the radio on. And so I learned an entire Hank Williams Sr., an album, a live record with all the stage patter in between. And I used to repeat the patter in between the songs. You know, I did everything but skip when the record would skip. I learned it, you know, verbatim.
Your father died when he was 55. He had a massive heart attack on the front porch of your home. How old were you when that happened?
I was 24, and my first record was a month away from being released.
Oh, so he never heard it?
No, I borrowed a tape recorder from another family, and I had a quarter-inch tape, and I took it to the house, and I played that record for him. And the last song on the record was Paradise. So when that song came on, he got up and walked into the dining room. It was dark in there. And he sat in the dining room while Paradise played. And he came back in the room afterwards, and I asked him how come he left the room when I called it his song, because he knew it was his story. And he said he wanted to pretend it was on the jukebox. But I think he just didn't want to see me see him with tears in his eyes.
So I want to close with another song from your new album. And I can't decide whether to play Boundless Love or I Have Met My Love Today. Do you want to choose one from those two?
Well, yeah, Boundless Love, I got an interesting story about.
Tell me.
I wrote that with three buddies of mine, David Ferguson, Dan Auerbach from Black Keys, and Pat McLaughlin. I think specifically we were going to write them for Dan Auerbach's solo project. And we wrote six songs in 2 days. And I didn't think any of the songs were for me. I thought we were writing them for Dan. And one of the songs was the song Boundless Love. And Dan didn't record it when he went in to do his solo project. So I looked at it when I was trying to gather songs up for the Tree of Forgiveness. And I liked the song, except I didn't think it was enough of me in it, like John Prine in it. So I called up Dan and said, I'm going to John Prine this song up. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, instead of the word food, I'm going to put frying pork chops in. And I said, and I got the whole thing. I want to replace the whole second verse with my old heart is like a washing machine. It bounces around until my soul comes clean. So Dan laughed, and that's what I did, is I just John Prine the song up, and it came out really pretty. And now I consider it kind of my song for my wife, Fiona, Boundless Love.
Well, let's hear it. And John Prine, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I woke up this morning to a garbage truck. Looks like this old horseshoe's done run out of luck. If I came home, or would you let me in? Fry me some pork chops and forgive my sin. Surround me with your boundless love. Confound me with your boundless love. I was drowning in a sea, lost as I could be, when you found me with your boundless love. Sometimes my old heart is like a washing machine. It bounces around till my soul comes clean. And when I'm clean and hung out to dry, I'm gonna make you laugh until you cry. Surround me with your boundless love. Confound me with your boundless love. I was drowning in a sea, lost as I could be, when you found me with your boundless love.
John Prine's new album is called The Tree of Forgiveness. Now film critic Justin Chang has a review of The King, which tracks the ups and downs of the past century of American life through the turbulent rise and fall of Elvis Presley. It's directed by documentary filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. Here's Justin's review.
Elvis Presley is one of the most endlessly mythologized figures in American history. But Eugene Jarecki's documentary, The King, reminds us that his legacy remains an inexhaustible subject. In this feverishly analytical and wide-ranging musical essay, Jarecki fuses Presley's turbulent life story to the very soul of America itself. He sees Elvis, in his myriad contradictions, as a symbol of the nation in all its grandeur and ambition, but also its blindness, corruption, and betrayal of its own promise. You might well poke holes in parts of his thesis afterward, but as an overarching metaphor, it's enormously stimulating. At the movie's best, the rhetorical force of Jarecki's polemic dovetails with the emotional momentum of Elvis's music. The King is a rise-and-fall biographical portrait, a treasure trove of archival footage, and a kind of concert film on wheels. Jarecki takes Elvis's 1963 Rolls-Royce out for a spin, retracing his life journey. He starts at his birthplace in Tupelo, Mississippi, then moves on to Memphis, where his musical career took off in 1954. The TV studios of New York, the movie sets of Hollywood, and the casinos of Las Vegas will soon follow, each destination sadder than the last. But this cross-country tour manages to be a blast as well as a bummer. Jarecki sticks celebrities and self-styled Elvis experts like Ethan Hawke and Alec Baldwin in the passenger seat. And he also brings in musicians like Emmy Sunshine in the Rain and the Stax Musical Academy Singers to hold a few thrilling jam sessions in the back seat. Not everyone interviewed for the film is so willing to go along for the ride. The news commentator Van Jones makes the case that Presley appropriated black music.
My father was born in Memphis in 1944, and there's probably nobody he hated more than Elvis Presley. As a black kid, seeing a white man take black music and become famous and not do anything for black people was a horrible offense. I think it's very hard to express sometimes the frustration that black people feel having given so much to the culture. And that great value, which really helps to define America, ultimately benefiting others.
Director Jarecki also extensively interviews the rapper Chuck D, who memorably dissed Elvis in the 1989 Public Enemy song, Fight the Power.
My conversation never was just this white dude stole black music. I think Sam Phillips was a business guy who tried to sell those records with black folks, could not get them across. Found a guy, you know, that's able to sell a black sound with a white face. He knew what to sell to America.
Is that in and of itself a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think culture is culture. Culture is to be shared. You know, you see a black person playing classical piano, you can't say, you know, because he doesn't have, you know, quote unquote, German roots, you know, that he can't play that classical piano good as anybody else. If a person's able to do the twisted, stanky leg and it happens to be Justin Timberlake, I think it's cool.
The TV writer and journalist David Simon says that all culture is essentially appropriation. He notes that if Elvis borrowed from pioneering black artists like Arthur Crudup and Lowell Fulson, he was equally influenced by white musicians such as Bill Monroe and Hank Williams. As the documentary shows us, Elvis brought it all together, synthesizing gospel, blues, and country with a swinging hips exuberance that the world had never before witnessed. The King takes us back to a time when it was all but impossible to turn on a radio or TV set and not see or hear Elvis Presley, and it reminds us of the near religious fervor with which his audiences embraced him. But while the movie never loses sight of Elvis, the timeless American artist, it also doesn't shy away from Elvis, the sellout, the star possessed of more talent than vision or principle. As the film recaps his ill-advised movie career, his descent into pill addiction, and his dismal final years as a Vegas lounge lizard, we see a man utterly trapped by his own celebrity. The Elvis as America metaphor emerges gradually, but with quickly gathering force. Jarecki frames Presley as a man who represented a great deal to many people, but who ultimately stood for too little. A few interview subjects ding Elvis for refusing to take a stand on the political issues of the day, the way Jane Fonda did on Vietnam and Muhammad Ali did on the civil rights movement. Much of The King was shot during the 2016 presidential election, and Jarecki spends some time interviewing white working-class Elvis fans who connect with the singer's rags-to-riches narrative. These same fans also connect with the promises of Donald Trump. With Trump's presidency, Jarecki argues, the country is now in its bloated Fat Elvis phase, complacent, wasting away from addiction and apathy, in danger of losing sight of the values it stands for. It's a grim view, but not a final one. After all, America hasn't left the building yet.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. My next guest is writer Stephen McCauley, the author of a new novel I really enjoyed called My Ex-Life. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, also loved it and described it as a smart comedy of manners about Macaulay's signature subject, namely the disconnect between erotic desire and intimacy and the screwball paths that people take on the way to finally arriving home. She added, Macaulay draws his readers into reflecting on some of the big questions, sexuality, mortality, failure, with the lure of laughter. McCauley is the author of 6 previous novels, including The Object of My Affection, which was adapted into a film comedy starring Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. His new novel centers around 2 people, David and Julie, whose brief marriage ended when he came out. 30 years later, they're brought together when Julie and her second husband are divorcing and their seemingly unambitious daughter isn't moving forward with her college applications. David's business is counseling students on how to get into college, so Julie calls him for help. That coincides with David's boyfriend having left him. When David and Julie meet again, they find they still have a deep connection, but this time with sexual intimacy out of the picture. McCauley is smart and funny writing about gay and straight relationships, friendships and marriages, college application essays, Airbnbs, Julie rents out rooms, and the kind of trouble an insecure teenage girl can get into through male flattery and her own desire to be daring. Stephen McCauley, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the novel, and I want to start with a reading from the very beginning of it. Would you read the beginning of My Ex-Life?
I'd love to. No, it was not the happiest moment of David Hedges' life. Soren, his partner of 5 years, had left him. He'd gotten fat. And somewhere in the midst of that, he'd woken up one day and realized he was no longer in his 20s or his 40s. The last person he expected to hear from was Julie Fisk. He and Julie had a history, albeit an ancient and complicated one. They hadn't seen each other in almost 30 years, hadn't spoken in more than 20, and David assumed that their story, like a few other things in his life, his desire to visit Petra, his vow to study the piano, his sexual relevance, had ended. This didn't diminish her importance to him. His memories of her lingered, faded by the years, in flattering ways. In his mind, they were still best friends. He heard of Julie Fisk infrequently through a few mutual friends and an occasional late-night computer perusal when he was feeling maudlin. Oh, Julie. He'd pieced together scraps and had come to the conclusion that she had a happy life, a husband, her second, a teenage daughter, a large house on the ocean north of Boston. She taught art at a private school for kids with learning problems, not what she'd imagined for herself in her younger incarnation, but who was he to judge? It appeared things had finally gone well for her. He was delighted. There had been years when he worried that she'd been set on a path of bad choices and bad luck by the mistake of her brief, misguided first marriage. To him.
That's Stephen McCauley reading from the opening of his new novel, My Ex-Life. Of course, Julie's life is nothing like what David imagines. Her marriage is ending. Her home by the ocean is falling apart. She wants to buy out her husband's half and can't afford to. It's like everything is a mess in her life. So when they come back together again because he's going to help her daughter with her college application, they redevelop the closeness they had when they were married, but without the pretense of a sexual relationship. What made you think about an ex-marriage becoming a different sort of partnership, one of deep friendship that is in some ways even more comfortable and enduring than the romantic sexual loves that they've had in their lives?
You know, I think there were several things that made me think about that. I mean, one is just that it seems to me all relationships evolve as time goes on, even for people who stay together as a couple. And even if the relationship remains sexual, essentially, that as you get older, needs change, needs for intimacy change and companionship change. And I wanted to have these people begin to reexamine what really worked in their relationship, the friendship, the closeness, and try to adapt it for, you know, needs later in life that are maybe less restless, less hormonal.
Are you saying less sexual?
Less sexual, yeah. But also, you know, several years ago, and this is kind of a funny source of inspiration for a novel that's essentially comic, and I hope it comes off as being optimistic in tone. But several years ago, there was a piece in the Sunday Times Magazine about a woman who, and this is as I remember it, I may be getting some of the facts wrong, but she was in her 60s and she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And it was very important to her that she control the last years of her life and also that she be absolutely in control of the means and the timing of the end of her life. And in order to negotiate all of that, she had to call on friends. And the person that she called on was her ex-husband, who they hadn't spoken to each other for many years. He was gay. And I was really struck by, I mean, you know, there's no Alzheimer's in my book. There's no end-of-life issues. There's a lot of middle-of-life issues. But I was really struck by the incredible friendship and trust that must have been between these two people, despite all the years of distance and despite disappointment and I'm sure a lot of anger and so on. And I found that really moving and I wanted to explore it in a completely different context.
Do you see there being certain burdens of a relationship that are lifted, like when they come back together, not in a marriage relationship, but just in a deep friendship relationship?
I think so. I think one of the struggles for me personally throughout my life with close relationships has been this fear of losing a piece of your identity, because you're making, you know, it's inevitable that you make compromises when you're in an intimate relationship. And I think that's a good thing, but it also can be very frightening. And I don't think they need to do that in this case. There's a sense that they can continue pursuing other relationships if they want to, and that they're not as bound to each other by this, the demands of kind of sexual intimacy.
And there's a certain type of jealousy that will not be a part of the relationship.
In theory. I don't know if you can ever get rid of that entirely.
Yeah.
You know, there's a scene in the novel where one of them, I can't remember actually which one it is, but I think it's Julie goes off to see someone who she may or may not be having an affair with. And, you know, David is completely supportive of this and he encourages her to do it. But at the same time, he's kind of waiting for her to come back from this date. And you know, he experiences a little bit of jealousy that's a bit more amorphous than it might be if they had a sexual relationship, but nonetheless is there.
I think it's interesting that you express concern that in a long-term relationship that you fear you would sacrifice some of your identity. And I say that because I always think of that as an issue that women face more than men, because women, I think, have traditionally been socialized to be liked, to be accommodating, to compromise. And so I think it's really easy for women to give up some of their identity in order to be liked, in order to be compromised, in order to meet somebody else in the middle. And in a marriage, that often means, you know, meaning like giving up some of yourself to your husband or your boyfriend or, you know, whatever.
Right.
So tell me how you experience that.
Well, I think if there's only one person who's giving up a piece of their identity, you know, if it's just the woman, the husband isn't, you know, moving at all in his needs or his demands, then maybe that's not such a great relationship. So I think that crosses gender lines, you know. And maybe for me it's particularly an issue because I tend to be somewhat introverted in social situations. And therefore the feeling of, you know, actually I have a partner who's very, who's a little bit more extroverted than I am. And so, sort of feeling that, you know, I'm losing my voice a little bit is sometimes an issue for me.
But I don't know who your partner is, but you might be more famous than he is. Like, you might be the one who's doing the readings and the tours.
In my own mind, yes. In the real world, I'm not sure.
So getting back to your novel, since the premise of the novel is a marriage that ended 30 years ago because the husband came out as gay, and that, mm-hmm. then these two people reunite as very close friends and teammates, you know, partners in a different kind of way. Do you know a lot of marriages that ended because one partner came out?
I do. I know a surprising number of marriages that ended that way. At one point, I can't remember, it was probably 20 years ago, I was in a running group, you know, that would meet twice a week and go for a run around the river in Boston. And I forget how many men there were in it, but at a certain point, you know, someone came out and said, well, I had been married 20 years, and this was a gay men's running group, by the way, and someone said, well, I had been married earlier, and, you know, it was like there were at least a dozen people in that group who had that experience, and I'm not sure what the connection was and why there were so many in this particular group, but there it was. I think it's not at all uncommon in my experience.
Were these people of different ages?
They were people of different ages. Mostly they were, you know, somewhere in the 35 to 55 range, I would say.
I'm wondering, you know, if it's easier for couples like that to stay friends afterwards, because the divorce wasn't necessarily based on, like, you hurt me or you wronged me or I can't get along with you. It's like, oh, I realize I'm gay, you know. So I could see the door remaining more open in a situation like that. And I know relationships where the door has remained very open and the couple has remained friends even though the marriage dissolved, you know, where one partner came out as gay.
Right. My observation is that that's often the case. And this group that I'm talking about, there were a number of people who had remained extremely close friends with their ex-wives. There is the other experience, which is that a lot of times the wife, or I suppose the husband, feels betrayed, that, you know, you should have known this sooner, you should have told me sooner. And those can be incredibly acrimonious separations.
So you came out in the 1970s when you were in your late teens.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there are so many issues relating to, like, sexual orientation and gender identity that have changed over the years in terms of how they're expressed and how people identify themselves. And you're seeing that not just as, like, a person in the world, but also as a professor at a university, and having been at universities for years, you've seen, like, you know, generations of students come and go and define themselves in different ways. There's a character in your new book who's a college student who goes by the name D, the letter D, and wants to be referred to as the gender-neutral they instead of he or she. That's a relatively new phenomenon. And, you know, the idea of, like, gender-neutral names and gender-neutral identity. And I'm wondering how you're processing that.
That's a really good question. It's a really big question right now in academia, especially.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, for me as a teacher, I am really happy to call my students whatever pronouns they want to be called by. I had a student recently who wanted to be called it. And I said, okay, I'll try it, you know. And, you know, whatever makes people feel accepted and seen the way they want to be seen is fine with me. At the same time, I find it a little bit confusing sometimes when people talk about the binary, the gender binary, because it seems to me, my experience of coming out in the 70s was that the joy, really, of coming out as gay was that you didn't have to think in terms of strict male and female roles, that you could define yourself as a man in any way you wanted to. And I never had any interests that were particularly traditional in terms of masculinity. And when I began reading particularly feminist writers like Betty Friedan and Germaine Greer, it was very liberating. It was like, well, you can define yourself as a man and still be a man, but have the interest that you want in, you know, 1920s music instead of rock and roll or whatever it happens to be. And I guess the students that I'm seeing now take a different approach to that, where they are embracing it more as being gender neutral. And so I'm trying to understand it more and be sympathetic to it.
So I want to end with some music. I'm always interested in the music that your characters like in your novels. I remember talking with you about Lee Wiley, the jazz singer from the 30s through, I guess, the 50s, who one of your main characters from an earlier book really loved. And in your new novel, My Ex-Life, one of the main characters loves French singers, including Françoise Hardy. And I thought we'd end with something from her. My introduction to her was in the film Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson film, because the two kids who are the main characters from that movie run away together, and there's a scene on the beach where they have a portable record player, and they're playing the Françoise Hardy song Le Temps d'Amour. And as they play it, they dance and then kiss, and they've never really kissed before, so it's a lovely scene. What's your favorite Françoise Hardy track that you'd like us to end with?
I think my favorite is called L'Amitié, which means friendship, and it has some of those same qualities of kind of being wistful and melancholy, but at the same time joyful. And because it's about friendship, you know, that's really what my novel is about, so maybe that's appropriate.
Good. Let's end with that. Stephen McCauley, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen McCauley's new novel is called My Ex-Life.
Beaucoup de mes amis sont venus des nuages Avec soleil et pluie comme simple bagage Ils ont fait la saison des amitiés sincères La plus belle saison des quatre de la terre Ils ont cette douceur des plus beaux paysages La fidélité des oiseaux de passage Dans leur cœur est gravée une infinie tendresse